to be somewhere where you wish the whole community could be there, and to feel so excited about what you were seeing that you need to tell it. And I suppose that a lot of people who write are people who somehow seen things and haven't told, or don't know how to tell it, or have seen it when the people to whom they want to say it are no longer there. In the book Worlds of Youth, the last vignette, which is a dialogue. In fact, Worlds of Youth was originally a monologue. And I felt it felt like a dialogue, so I took a red pencil and underlined what seemed to be the other one conversing with me, in me. It's like admitting schizophrenia and coloring one blue and the other line red. But the boy in this last vignette, his name was Curtis. And when Elvis Presley was it, when he was everything, Curtis was a Presley fan, and I was pastor in San Antonio, and we all went down to see Elvis Presley one night. I'll never forget that night. Curtis loved Christ, and he loved speeding. He loved to drive fast. That's quite a combination. I suppose a lot of people have combinations like that. They love Christ and they love speeding, or you name it. You know, there are a lot of things you can love with Christ. Well, that was his. That was what he liked, was speeding. Curtis was a real gentle, spirited boy. I took him along on calls with me sometimes. I remember once we went into a house, and by the time we left the house, we were in the back room, and the woman had admitted somehow to me that her uncle, 80 some years old, was not baptized and could hardly hear, was bedfast, and she wept all the way into the room confessing that she was concerned about him. And we went in, and Curtis was a godparent, this old man, as we had a German baptism. That was his style of life. He liked it. He liked surprises. He liked not knowing quite what was around the corner if you went too fast. And one night he did. And he just wrapped his car all around the pole. And I didn't know what to say. And so it was 7 years later that I said something about Curtis. I found it very difficult at the time, even at the funeral, because a few weeks before that, or months before that, I don't recall, for some reason his mother didn't want me to be the pastor of the family anymore, so they transferred, and so I went to Curtis's funeral and sat in this neighboring church in the back of the balcony, the top row, and watched it. And I had to deal with it somehow. And I think one of the styles of life of a Christian is that eventually you have to deal with the truth. You have to, like Marcus was saying yesterday, you have to get at the thing of the thing. And so I had to deal with my feeling, but I also had to deal with the theology of loving Christ and wrapping yourself around the pole going 85 and 35 mile an hour zone. And I wanted to get myself into the story, and so when you hear the story, you'll hear about the preacher in this story. I make myself to be his father in a very elegant downtown church, having the honor of being very busy, which is another form of speeding. So, well, you'll catch it. It's a dialogue, and if I really wanted to do it, I suppose I'd go to a parking lot or someplace where some cars were smashed, and we'd go out there and read it. This is really not the place to read it. There'd be many places where you could go to get the feel and the context for this. He doesn't look natural. Well, he isn't natural. He's dead. Yeah. With the speedometer locked at 85 and the engine wrapped around his spinal cord and the station wagon around the pole like a jelly roll. Well, you can enjoy a jelly roll, but what can you do with a young driver and his head hanging by the nape of the neck? Makes you want to feel sorry and tell him he shouldn't have done it and tell God he didn't mean it. But he wasn't that way. And everybody's here to sing and pray. Worship. Worship for this. And for this there is forgiveness. For driving 85 in a 50-mile zone. For driving 85 there is forgiveness. And for smashing his dad's new car to smithereens. For smashing the car, for wrecking it completely, for blowing out every tire. And for the grief he's causing the family. For all the grief. And for his hankering to speed. For all the hankering. And for the bad example he set in the community. For the bad example. For getting clobbered before his time was up, just 18. There's forgiveness for being just 18. For dying at 18 at the wheel when it's all your fault. There's forgiveness for fault. But he was reckless. And so are others, and so is his father. Reckless. Risking his life every week, day or night. Regular daredevil, no doubt. Yeah, daredevil. He died when he was 37. His wife was 34, and the three boys were little. Where it happened, in the pulpit, Easter, the third service. It was his 13th service that week, Holy Week, 13 with everything else. Oh, we warned him. He kept right on going like a house of fire. But he was a minister, the boy, his own son. All three choirs sang at the funeral. All three. Yeah, three still sing today. There is forgiveness for dying. For disease and dying, speed and dying, overwork and dying, recklessness and dying. They all die different. We need forgiveness for dying. Then a little postlude. You know, because his mother wouldn't allow me to say anything to the family, to the situation, I decided to tell 70,000 purchasers of a book, or how many more. Because I had to deal with him, I had to deal with my own death. And I remember the first time I came to the National Office of the American Lutheran Church, I gave a sermon, sermonette, and it seemed so strange to one of the executives there that I should ask for the forgiveness for dying, that he took me to task for it. He said, you can ask for the forgiveness of sin, and you can ask for forgiveness of anything else, but you don't ask for forgiveness for dying. No, he wasn't going to go that far. He'd pray for the resurrection, but he wasn't going to ask for the forgiveness for death. It was just a strange combination of words is what creativeness is. It's when you juxtapose words that don't seem to belong together because you haven't heard of them together. You're out of a rut. You're driving a new track. Maybe with one wheel. You know, you drive a new track in the country, you drive in between, you skid back in and you try to get out. Well, that's one example of, I think, a style of life, and that is that you deal with the event. You look at it until you're in it. You look at it until you are part of it, as Marcus said was saying last night. Walking along the trail today, I want to pick this up now. I took Walden along, thought that maybe to read Walden on the way to Copper Basin would be better than reading Walden back in the office. And this is really delightful here where Thoreau says this sentence. I wonder if you can feel if you can identify with this. At a certain season of our life, we are accustomed to consider every spot as the possible site of a house. You know, a certain time of life, perhaps more than just a season of our life, we're accustomed to consider every spot as the possible site of a house. And I know that all along the way I was thinking, wow, if we could live here. Wouldn't it be a place to live? I'd like to live under this big tree. You hear that squeaking tree? I'd like to live right outside that squeaking tree and all the way up. And wanting to live everywhere. And then it ran on here, and Walden describes how he did this in his imagination. I mean, he really owned property with a nickel in his pocket. He said, "My imagination carried me so far that I even had the refusal of several farms. The refusal was all I wanted, but I never got my fingers burned by actual possession. The nearest that I came to actual possession was when I bought the Hollowell place," then he describes it, "and had begun to sort my seeds and collected materials with which to make a wheelbarrow to carry it on or off with. But before the owner gave me a deed of it, his wife," every man has such a wife, "changed her mind and wished to keep it, and he offered me $10 to release him. Now, to speak the truth, I had but 10 cents in the world, and it surpassed my arithmetic to know if I was that man who had 10 cents, or if I was that man who had a farm, or if I was that man, you know, who had $10, or if I was perhaps all together. However, I let him keep the $10 and the farm too, for I had carried it far enough. Or rather, to be generous, I would say I sold him the farm for just what I gave for it, and as he was not a rich man, made him a present of $10. And still had my 10 cents in my pocket and seeds and materials for a wheelbarrow left. I mean, to become so rich that you could possess a farm, give a guy $10, you know, to boot, when you only have 10 cents in your pocket, is really quite a transaction. And then comes this payoff line. I found thus that I had been a rich man without any damage to my poverty." It's a little subtle. And I guess that's his way of describing that you can own and you can possess in your own imagination even the kingdom of heaven. You know, even that is yours. This is quite a fantastic thing. I would like to have those boards, a few of those boards, yes. Why don't you just pass them back and each take one, okay?
Take a few of them and pass them back?
Just take a couple. Mm-hmm. Don't really know what I'm going to do with them yet, but they're here and we may as well use them. Somebody left them here. Okay.
These two?
Well, that's all right. We have enough. You don't have one. I'm just wondering what all we could do with this. That's pretty good. I don't know. I usually work with more interesting things like this when I want to be creative. You can pick and choose a little bit. I was in two different textures. That was an interesting thing today. I felt some trees that were smoother than sandpaper would get them. We saw a rock today, and the texture of these two are very, very different from each other. Thought how interesting it would be sometime if we came into church blindfolded. Well, even not blindfolded, we could shut our eyes. It'd be a good way to have night service in the day. If you just shut your eyes, you wouldn't know that the lights were on. A lot of people like the night service, you know. It would be just as easy to shut your eyes. I'm letting you in on a style of life now that I would call, it's Christian, and I think it's also creative. And it is, you kind of let you ramble along out loud.
And you're not too careful about where you're going because you don't really know. But when you turn a corner and you meet someone else, all of a sudden you have a marvelous thing happen. Well, anyway, this reminds me of two sides having different textures. Did you ever take a hike and notice that one side of a rock was had the sun beating on it and the other side was in the shade? You take your hand, like take one hand on each side, and you can feel the contrast. It's beautiful. Now, my wife taught me that going up the mountain today, and I keep remembering that she teaches very little children, and that they depend on reality. They depend on the truth, and they don't walk past it. And they get close enough that they can touch the truth. You couldn't tell by looking at the stone or the rock what I just told you. You could only tell it if you bent down and took the time, you know, to touch it. And children going along a path like that, I'm sure, or playing on it, would stumble across, trip over the idea that one side of a stone was perhaps, I don't know, 10, 20 degrees different in temperature. Again, maybe that isn't very interesting. But there are a lot of things that, like that, that are interesting because they have a contrast. Because they have more to them than you thought. There's more there than met the eye. I was just thinking, what a beautiful thing if, of course, our fingertips are kind of dulled. I don't know how you get them opened up in the church a little bit. We don't use them. If I bump you like that, I tell you I'm sorry. Didn't mean to, and I won't do it again next Sunday. Now, that's as close as we usually get, huh? I don't know. But if we did want to use our fingertips, this is texture, and this is texture. And some people say that the church should teach us religious concepts not so much as though we can hear, but as though we are blind. In other words, if you could communicate a religious concept to a blind person, you would probably be doing that person a great favor, even though the person isn't blind. I don't know. Let's see the difference. If I were to communicate to you as though you were blind, the idea of love, how might I do it? I'm just picking that one out of the air. How might I do it? Now, I'd say I'm being creative because you're not blind. I can see you, so why are we fooling around like this, you know? Pretending. That's right, pretending, imagining, fantasizing. But let's suppose that you're blind. Asha, shut your eyes. Yeah, she's blind. And I'm blind. Now, suppose we really wanted to communicate love, affection for each other. What are some of the senses that we would probably, I'm talking to you already, what are some of the senses that we would probably want to use?
You mean smile you couldn't see?
No, that's the trouble.
I would say.
Oh, well, yes, we could do that.
Yes, that
comes pretty easy, yeah, right. Now open your eyes. We wouldn't have to do that now, could we? We could just smile again. I don't really know what that means. I just wanted to open up the idea. If you could imagine teaching normal, you know, like we are, normal. If you could imagine teaching people, but concentrating somehow on communicating as though the other person was blind, see what you would do. See what that would mean. How you would alter what you're doing. Over against that, concentrate on the other person being deaf, but could see. Just a little thing to work with sometime. I read it somewhere, and I just wondered if it was true. One of the styles of life that I think the Christian works with is is accident. I haven't dealt with this board. I did a little bit by saying its texture was were different. Make a nice board for a child to color on. Could put his paper on it. Then if he went over the edges, then he could keep his mistakes. That would be nice if you could keep track of your mistakes. And you could hang them up somewhere and you could see what you did that gets to be increasingly beautiful as you increasingly go off the paper. And then if the teacher would approve that and like that and not blame you for that, that might not be, that might do something to you. If you were a painter and you put your paint on here and you had your easel over here, and you cleaned your brush over here, something like that, then that might be the leftover when your painting was done. Then what would you do with it? You could throw this away. This sort of gave origin to this cleaned. You know, on this your brush wept. On this your brush was again cleaned and renewed and readied to do its next job. So I frankly have as much affection for this as I have for the final painting. I mean, this is part of it. I don't like a book when it's in its final printed form. I like it much better when some songwriter says, I would like to take those four lines and sing them. Because I think the style of Christian life is that it wants to continue. It believes in resurrection and life. And it doesn't give priority to any part of the process. I cherish as much the first sentence that I write in any poem, and I never throw away those old pages. I've got piles of them. And now Marxhausen would shovel them out. He told us last week, you know, that he doesn't use the same Christmas decorations every year. But I don't know why I keep them, but except that I think that it's like the original act. When I first wrote the sentence that became edited, printed, and bound and sold all along that way, the time I remember is when I took usually a pencil, not a pen, because I don't like a pen, and I don't like that pen at all. That pen fights me. That pen tells me that it doesn't like me and that I'll have to work very hard to make it go. I just happen to take along because I run out of the pens I like. I'm very sensitive about the things that with which I work, and I don't like that pen. I guess a farmer feels that way about tools, and I guess a woman feels that way about the stuff with which she works. And I don't mind stopping and having some feelings about the things with which I work. I'm going to show you something that I brought in here today. Now this piece under the bar. Now I don't know where if you could find the piece, if you could take the bark off, where it would be like, I don't know if this is a negative and the bark is a positive. Do you know what I mean? When, underneath are these lines. Now, if you take that bark off and you look at the bark, where the bark, rises, this is you know, this indents. So you've got just the opposite effect as you have here, right? In other words, you've got a positive and a negative, in a sense. You know what I mean? In talking about a film, that what is the main space here on the other is the main space. Now, when I look at this, what do you look at right away? Would you point to what you see? Uh-huh. I was looking here. She pointed in here, and I pointed in here. See? You saw these more right away, and I was looking at this. It's like the guy who came to our house and said, I sure like the space between your furniture. I thought he was crazy. He never said anything about our furniture. Once he did, and he insulted it. That is, he looked at our beams and said they were fake and therefore they were phony. In other words, they weren't doing their thing. They were not honest. It was not truthful. He was a very creative person, and he said, I like the space between your furniture. Now, you examine that very much, that idea of space between the furniture. The space between our furniture is pretty... just take a look at it. Just look at the stat. You know, it's not that dynamic. There isn't a great deal that we can do about the way the space is between our furniture. Be very interesting sometime to go into your house and just say, "I wonder how the space is between our furniture." You might do some rearranging. You might throw out some things.
You.
Hmm?
You might throw you out.
Yeah. I guess you'd have to then stop and say, well, what do I want the space to do? You know, what style of life do I want to live in it? If you could design, there are some people who build houses their whole lives around patios. And there are some people who live, build their houses around,
the kitchen sink.
Yeah. Some people believe in lots of walls and tiny rooms. Some people believe in open space. But wouldn't it be something if the Christian church not only built, decided to have help congregations build churches, but had a commission that would help people design their houses and would sit down with a family and not ask what color scheme do you want yet, but would first of all say what's the purpose of your family life? What do you intend to do together? You know, who do you intend to be? What does your family like to do, and what do you want to become in the next 4 or 5 years that you live here, or what? The house might not sell too well to the next family. But let's just imagine. Creativity says that you don't have to worry about it being that practical if it's truthful. If you really could design a house, if you could design a house for a style of life that you want to perpetuate, what might that be? Let's just imagine that for a few minutes and just get some of these things out in the air and say something to each other about how it would be quite different, perhaps. Just throw in an idea. We're not going to build this house, but most of us live in one, and I'd just like to have you toss this out.
It might be a gymnasium.
Okay, a gymnasium, that you would have some running space and some jumping space in a house. Okay?
I'd like to have one with a transparent roof that would watch the stars.
Okay. All right, I mean, think of all the wishful thinking here. Yeah.
It sounds great when you heard that in Japan, every house has its elder.
How about that?
I don't know if any American houses have elders.
It'll work, yeah. Okay, let's keep, let's add to the idea of what we could have for a house built for Christian family or lifestyle. Yes, a sauna with a cool and a plunge.
How do you have walls that could be complete, outside walls that could be completely removed so I would be almost outside all the time when the weather is clear?
Yes. Okay. This is pretty important because since we don't live in houses like that, we're going to deal with our wishes in just a little while. And one way to deal with them is either fantasy or imagination. And imagine yourself through those walls. Or just discard the whole idea. Let's throw in a few more architectural ideas here.
Banisters
for the children. For sliding? Down. Down like that, okay?
Without nails in them.
Yeah, very slidable.
Lots of room for other people.
Pardon?
Lots of room for other people.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. There's no lock so they could get in.
So they could get in from the side door or?
Any door.
Any door. Okay, you were going to say something.
He's done.
Anything else?
I was just going to say no dining room. That's
okay. All right.
What about one that can continually face the sun with the on a
pivot?
Yeah. Rotation situation. Mm-hmm.
You're very interesting to back up a little bit and try and describe what kind of functions we're trying really to build for. Why don't we list a few of those? In other words, what are the family purposes that you had in mind in order that you would have said these things? For instance, the gymnasium, what did you really mean?
Place for my boys to play, yes.
Her husband.
Yeah, her
husband.
Okay. Aren't you getting at ways in which we should structure our homes to enhance our Christian living rather than? It seems like everything that's being mentioned here, almost everything that I've heard mentioned, is sort of things that we'd like for me, myself. Aren't you?
All right, let's ask. What was your reason for the big dining room then?
Maybe that is.
Because I always have so many people coming to my house for dinner, for eating, and I have to do shifts. Or I put the kids out in the bathroom and the adults are on the table in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I just put it out in the front room. So I'd love to have a big dining room where we could all just sit down all at once.
Okay. Why did you say the guest room?
Well, why did you say no dining room?
Oh, Kent, yeah. You said no dining room.
Yeah, I was really saying no rooms that are such special purpose rooms that they are used only occasionally. So I'm not in disagreement with the dining room concept, but I'm in disagreement with anything that sets up a special facility and we use it when company comes or we use it on occasion. And I had in mind the family room concept as the house in the living area.
Okay. What's the reasoning behind one or two of the other answers that were given?
One is the open sky and the stars that they speak to us about God, about His created anything.
Okay.
After the sun, that the people are more relaxed in the sun. In their fear.
What is the most relaxing interpersonal room in most homes?
and bathroom. Well, that's our family room.
Ain't your first one?
To be honest, it's the only time I can get my husband to sit down long enough so we can all talk to him.
Beautiful. Boy, that's an affirmation of the of creation if I ever heard it. We have a song in the village that we sing and we love. Some of us love it. You say yes, yes, yes. And, you know, you say yes to the whole being. And that's another thing, that it's not only the tactile sense, but it's the whole person to whom we need to say yes. I think that's one of the things about Holden Village and about the village life, is that it gives you a chance really to see a person in more than her Sunday clothing, and you can say yes to her even when she looks a mess. You know, and you mean it. And the other way around. Okay. I'd like to, I would really like to have something happen here, and I'm looking for something that looks like it could do it. Build a fire up? Yeah. What was that? Do you think a fireplace is a good thing to talk through and around? You like it?
Mm-hmm.
I think I'll tell you a story. I'll tell you a story about a family. Maybe a few, I think a few of you have heard this story. A few years ago, 12 of us went up to northern Minnesota. They were boys and girls, youth. And there were two of us, a man and I, were their advisors. And all I knew that weekend we were going to be the family of God, and we were going to celebrate Holy Communion. That was my only agenda. And all the way up and back, I knew that we were going to plan our program as we went. First thing I wanted to do was to get the girls and the boys mixed, you know, properly in the two cars. But before I got out to my car, they were already mixed in their way, so that there were six and six, and I happened to end up with the two beautiful girls in the front seat and all the guys in the back and the leftover girl. The other car, I don't remember who rode in that car. So this girl in the back, not at all a pretty girl, turned out to be the most beautiful one in the weekend. But because she needed so much loving, and because the fellows found that, we all found that she had a lot of affection for us all. On the way up, they all went to sleep in the back, and I looked back and they looked like a puzzle. And I thought, well, you know, that this weekend is going to have to do with communion, and we'd also announced that it had to do with sexuality. And I thought, well, looking back there, they're all touching each other, and that has to do with both communion and sexuality. So I thought our theme was on the way. Didn't know how we were going to progress, and I didn't even worry about it. I didn't worry what time they were going to come in or anything like that. We just went along. And the two girls started to talk about maybe we'd put on a play. I said, fine. And then they said, and you could be Jesus. And I was personally insulted. I didn't want to say anything because I didn't see why the minister had to be Jesus when we had all these other people who could be Jesus. So I said, I think it takes two to be Jesus. And they said, well, what do you mean? And I said, I don't know, but we could try and find out. We thought about this a little bit. All I knew that somehow my first compulsion was to say that I, her brokering, dressed in a, you know, kind of a bathrobe, am not Jesus. That's not Jesus. But being someone to someone, you know, two people, Christ coming, says, that's where I am. So I guess somehow, from Sunday school days or somehow, maybe that Bible verse that talks about she's hungry and you feed, I am there. I just said, it takes two to be Jesus. And they said, hey, that's a pretty good theme for the weekend. I said, that's our theme, it takes two to be Jesus. I thought that was pretty good for communion and pretty good for sexuality. I couldn't get these things separated too much. You know, I thought maybe we'd go out and have two topics. One would be on male and female, and the other one would be on communion. I couldn't get these two separate. I know Christ does talk about the bride and the bridegroom and the church, you know, in communion, so that I wasn't too worried, but I wondered how we could deal with them. And we got to the first stopping place, the restaurant, and the kids said, hey, let's all go in and have a hamburger. So they all went in the back room, and they all crowded into this tiny room. The proprietor said, why don't you spread them out? I said, I don't know. They don't want to spread out. They want to get back. They want to all jam in there. He was carrying chairs in there, and they were just jammed in this tiny room. He said, what's the matter? I said, I guess they want to be together. You know, I thought I had this all mimeographed, you know, ahead of time. I don't know where I'd have gone. I started to analyze where is a leader. Now, I know that some of you have come up with youth to Holden Village, and you probably ask yourself this question many times. And I always figure that a leader is about, he's always with the others, and about a half step behind and a half step ahead. That's how I visualize myself. So as we were getting ready to go in the car again, two girls came out late, and I said, I forgot communion bread. So I thought I could buy some alone. And I thought, well, why? So I hollered and said, hey, let's get some communion bread. They said, okay. And we went to the grocery store because there was no deaconess home in sight. We went to the grocery store, and I remembered what Roland Bainton had told me at Holden Village. He said, in Luther's day, they did not have white bread, they had only black bread. And I thought that would be great. So I said to the girls, we will have black bread because it's very Lutheran. Well, when they heard the explanation, they were very pleased because they liked the idea. They thought it maybe had to do with black is beautiful. As far as I was concerned, I wanted it for both reasons. But anyway, we went in and they found black bread, and one girl screamed. I don't know why they always scream when they find new things, but she screamed, I found it. I went over there and I said, we can't use it because it's sliced. I was so glad I didn't have to argue with her. She understood perfectly. But when we were going in, a little more complication had set in because one girl said, oh, if we're going to have black bread, let's have butter because I love butter with black bread. And I said to myself, Herb, you should have planned better. And that's part of the style of, I think, the style of a Christian is that he doesn't plan everything out, but that he goes with life. And he really seeks where the others are. So we kept going, and when they didn't argue about the slices, they knew what I meant. I said we've got to have one big piece. And then the other one screamed. She said, I found it, strudel. There it was, big round loaf of strudel. And then I saw this icing on it. I said, what do we do with the icing? Because I couldn't imagine wafers with icing, you know, ice wafers. This was all going through my mind, I must admit. It was going through their mind too. They said, that's no problem. We'll just eat it with the bread. And then we won't need the butter, the other girl said. That helped me. And whenever you can get a little help, just take it. Now, this is a peculiar style of living because I had never picked out communion bread with my congregation before. I had never done that. So we said, let's not tell the others. not because we're ashamed of it, but because we want to surprise them with the bread. So we hit it. Almost like Easter. And we would uncover it. Well, anyway, we got up there. 10:30 at night, I said, we're going outside to pray. They said, why do we go outside when it's warm in here? I said, because you always pray where it's warm. Why don't we go out and connect prayer with cold? But they said, you did that last year. I said, do you remember it? And they said, we sure do. We walked on water. It was frozen. But we talked about walking on water. And that was a test. It's hard to walk on water. You very seldom get a chance to walk on water and deal with that. And one of the girls had, the year before, had just washed her hair, and her hair was frozen out there. And I remember that I gave her my cap. I had never given a parishioner my cap before, and frozen on the way back on her behalf. We're friends forever. So they said, okay, we'll go out to pray. Where do we go? I said, I'll find a place. I looked around and I couldn't find an altar out there underneath the trees and in the snow. So I put my, licked my finger like it were, as it were, and I just made a big circle in the snow. I thought, that's a pretty nice altar. It was round. And I took two candles, because it takes two to be Jesus, and I put them in the middle. That's a pretty altar. It was all decorated, nice pine trees and a round altar, snow. Moonlight, couldn't beat it, couldn't buy it. And I thought, my goodness, what if I hadn't thought of that? What if we had planned back home, and hadn't gone with what was there? Now I wondered what to do next, because I hadn't planned. But all the way along, I'd heard this one guy nagging about his mother. And I thought, and a lot of other kids, didn't like their mothers much better, nor fathers. And my son was, I wasn't sure. So I said to myself, we have got to deal with that. Well, I wanted a very simple outline because I didn't have a bulletin. I said to the kids, we will have two parts to our worship service tonight. The first is called love and the first is called hate and the last is called love. So we stood around this altar about 7 feet away. And I said, Bruce, we are now in part one, and would you please lead us in hate? I've heard you all the way up. You do it rather well. Would you mind leading us? And he said, no, I'd love to. So he said, what do? I said, you blow out the candle. So he began to blow out the candle. It made him very angry that he couldn't blow them out. And I didn't have to tell him, he began to spit. Now he got all the help from the other kids, so all the kids were trying to blow out the candles, and we had a regular hating session going on around our altar. I had nothing to do with it. I couldn't control it, I couldn't stop it, I didn't know where it was going. All I knew was that there were 12 kids trying to blow out two candles when it takes two to be Jesus. I was glad I didn't have a bulletin, because this thing was really going. Bruce leaned down to get a snowball. And I thought, I bet he's never snowballed an altar before. And I wonder what's going to happen when he suddenly thinks about that he's snowballing an altar. And he threw the snowball and he missed. And soon all were helping him, except one girl. And when the first candle went down, I could still hear her scream. You don't have to kill it! She didn't remember that she said that, but I heard it. And when they were both down, it was just like Vietnam. It was just battle scarred. That white altar was just shot full of holes. Now I noticed that our organist for the weekend, our musician was Simon and Garfunkel in record form. So I happened to think of our organist, Simon and Garfunkel, in one of their anthems. Silent Night, Holy Night. You know that one? Okay, I thought, well, we can do it. I said, you have done very well. Look at our altar. We have hated it. We've hated very well. We will sing a song. And we sang Silent Night, Holy Night. Didn't need any explanation. Now I said, we will come to part two, and we will say some love words. We will fill the area with love words. We hadn't been together long enough to fill the area with love acts. Some of the oldest people I know are in their teens. I don't know if they're so old or if they're not sure how young they are. But they got younger by the end of the weekend. Now it's glad. But that night, part two was love words. Then we were all done. Didn't take very long. And they liked that. And they could remember. It doesn't have to take an hour to remember it. Then we went in and made Valentines, and they told each other off. They sent hostile Valentines to each other and some loved ones. 2 days later, we had communion. Well, whenever I'd send them off, one time we went out in pairs, or they went out, boys and girls. I don't know why I did it, but as they went away, I told them to snowball each other. So I sent them out in twos to snowball each other. Just go away. And my last parting verse was, it takes two to be Jesus. I don't know what it meant to them. I didn't really care. I just wanted somehow to get mixed up. Jesus, boy and girl, communion, sexuality, and all of it. And I wanted to put it in the same weekend. I didn't want to deal with sexuality this weekend, communion next weekend, and Jesus on the third. Came communion Sunday morning. We sat on the floor, down in their favorite room. Brought out the wine, brought out the bread. The girls decorated the rug with two candles upside down, just as they had fallen in the snow. Well, I said, we must be in love with one another. I read Jesus' text. So I said, one thing I learned from Mrs. Hinderley was how to give a toe rub at Holden Village. Would you like to... I could give you a foot washing, but if you'd like a toe rub, I'll give you a toe rub. Well, most of them thought that would be pretty funny. And if I could teach the other counselor, then he could take half the circle and I could take the other half, which I did. I got to the first girl, and this was this ugly girl. You know what I mean? I talked to her about her feet. I talked to her about her body. And I tell you, she talked to me about herself. It was beautiful. We went around. Then it was time for the wine. So we passed around the wine and we smelled it. They began to laugh. They thought it was great. Beautiful. You smell it. Finally, someone said, is this really communion? I put it up to a vote, and they voted yes. We kept going. Didn't sound like communion to some of us. Didn't sound like communion to me in a way. And three times we asked the question, is this really Holy Communion? And each time the group voted yes, unanimously. I don't know. It would be something for some of you ministers here in this room to put up to the congregation for vote some Sunday, whether it really seems like Holy Communion. We got all done. There were so many crumbs all over the floor or on that blanket. Four girls got a hold of each end of the blanket, and just, you know how they kind of, you know, what do we do with the leftovers, Pastor? Only they didn't ask me. You know what they did? They hurried upstairs, and I hurried after them because I wasn't going to miss this. I didn't know what was going to happen. And they opened the door, and they flung it out, and they said, and the birds will eat too. I thought, my goodness, where did they learn all of that Lutheran theology? That is beautiful. That is beautiful. That all creation, you know, that this fruit of the earth, you know, which really was ours, and through which he came to us, and that he is indeed our Savior, but he is also King of all creation. And as they threw it out into the snow and said, you know, invited the birds to the meal, I thought, wow. Talk about closed communion. You know, we're still worrying about who can come to the altar rail. Closed communion. And these kids were sharing the bread with all creation. I mean, they blew my mind. And I thought, oh my, am I glad that I followed them? Am I glad that I followed them through this week? Just a half inch behind them. Well, that's kind of that's a little bit of the style of life that I think the Christian has when he's open to curiosity. That's what creativity is. Curiosity, open to the future. Hope, I think, is the word. When he's expectant, I think that's like Advent. When he like newness and isn't afraid of surprise. I mean, that you don't mind Easter. That you don't say, I don't want an Easter, but that you say, here's another Easter, and I guess here's one, and you just are a kind of person that, like the kid that's always turning a rock over a little and peeking and glad that you haven't lost your curiosity. That's kind of the style of life. It's not so, you know, it doesn't always come off just perfect, whatever that is. But there's something that happens that usually is indescribable, because when people go away, it's like Pentecost. It's hard really to define. You can describe it, but you can't really define it. Well, now, maybe you'd like to comment on that. The reason I had this hour this evening is that I thought maybe some of you want to sit around a fire and think about the matter of creativity, because that's partly what I think Holden Village is. It's a place for Christians and non-Christians, I believe, too, to be curious. But how can you have curiosity and still keep your job? Now, how can you go with curiosity when you live in an institution that very often can't stand where curiosity takes you? And for which there isn't much time sometimes for being curious, because you're carrying out a program. Okay, who wants to say something? Pro, con, anything? Just for a few minutes, yet.
Was wine necessary for communion?
Well, we had it. It was homemade. It was made by a woman whose son had died on a motorcycle just a few months before. And she made it out of grape juice, and she put a balloon on it. She learned how to do this, you know. So we talked about this wine. It was, I don't know. The other night we almost ran out of wine here in Holden Village. We had to borrow from each other, and I thought, well, what if we don't have any wine? I think I'd have asked the community whether we could have water. I think I would have asked the community, could we use water? I think that it said yes.
What about coffee?
What?
What about coffee?
Coffee? Yeah, I think that maybe some of them would have wanted coffee. I think they would have decided in their own circle. We had small groups. I think they would have decided what they would have wanted. We probably would have gone out to find it.
Would their vote determine whether it's communion or not?
Well, I don't know how else you would. We could wait for the San Antonio Convention in October. You see, there are a lot of things that I don't know if vote. Yeah, I think you're quite right. I doubt if voting determines it. There was a father there with a son waiting. He's waiting to go to San Antonio to vote whether his 10-year-old could commune, and he's going to commune his 10-year-old. See, he's a minister. So this is what, this was heavy on his mind. When the bread came around in the circle, his 10-year-old son broke off a piece and said, "Hey, Dad, the body of Christ." And the San Antonio Convention isn't until October. So the father went out there, went out of that communion service, asking the same question. You know, does the vote do it? His answer was no. But Christ had come to him as his son ministered to him.
Are two different things, though. In that case, it was wine and bread.
Yeah.
But the question of what age could participate in it.
Yeah, right. Well, we're dealing with a situation here that didn't arise when you say, you know, could you use coffee and so forth. I've never been in a situation where I didn't have enough wine. But I'm just saying that if there was no wine in the village and we wanted to continue our communion, I don't think I would postpone it until next week. I would continue it into the night with something to drink. I think one of the things that came to some of us was very impressive. We brought, you know, the celebrants brought the bread back, which were loaves of bread baked here in the village, and there was so much left over. I asked if anyone wanted more, so we took it back out until everybody had eaten all the bread, and it was an eating time. And I think for some of us, we realize that Christ doesn't come in the flat wafer, but he comes in the eating of the bread, in the eating of the bread. Not in the bread, but in the eating of the bread. And that participle, eating, for me, just loomed big. Because when the person gave me a piece of bread to eat, it was a bigger piece than I would have taken. Now, when you got a communion wafer, you got that control. Everything is the same. That's very well organized. But this wasn't very well organized. This guy was very generous. He wanted me to have a lot. The bishop from Texas, and he just gave me it. Just chunked it. He gave it to me. Now I had it in my mouth. Now I wanted to swallow it in a hurry so we could get on with the service. I couldn't. I was up against eating. I was not up against a wafer. I was up against eating. And the word kept coming to my mouth, to my mind. Saliva. I can't help it. I'm just telling you. Because later on, I was aware of this as a celebrant, that was what the other people were worrying about now. Because I know when I get the wafer now, I know exactly what I do with the wafer. I do it every time, and I can do it in about a half a second. And I can be ready for the next. But now I was eating. And suddenly it dawned on me that this was a fantastic experience, that Christ was coming to me in the eating of bread. Now that enlarged bread for me, eating of bread. Now I would say that wine, the same thing, when we finally found some more wine, some of us got to drink twice. So it was in the drinking of wine. Now if there were no wine, I would love to run into that problem. I'm not going to plan it. But I would love to be in a Christian community that had to deal with having no wine. I wouldn't go to the scriptures for my answer. I would go to that Christian community. Now, at that point, I would trust this community of Christians who all know the scripture as I know it and you know it. And we would decide. That's what I meant. We would decide.
The question that comes to my mind, perhaps is even more relevant than whether or not this was a valid communion.
Yep.
Back then, is to turn this thing around and say, in our congregation of worship on Sunday morning, with the ministers and the sublime and all, if there are people in that communion who would vote no, is that communion? I mean, does the vote there have significance?
In southern Minnesota, I was on my way to a communion service, and my wife said, "Why are you taking a black stool?" And I said, "I don't know, but I'll figure it out on the way." And I did. All of a sudden, it dawned on me, this was Earth Week. Now, you know, what I like the black stool. I like the black stool very much. And I was driving along, and I saw the black earth of southern Minnesota, and I stopped the car, got a great big chunk of black earth, put it in the paper bag, and went on the road. Got to the communion service, and I put this great big chunk of black earth on the altar beside the bread and the wine. In Earth Week, 7 people didn't commune, but 70 communed with vigor. So, you know, I didn't try to offend anybody. I was just wondering, is there any other way to remember that, you know, it's the fruit of the earth. And like Bishop Sheen said at Kennedy's funeral, as that parade of water and bread and wine was coming to the altar, he said the whole earth would love to get on that altar and man with it. I thought, what a fantastic thing if I would have asked everybody in the congregation to sit on the altar and join the elements so that you don't get something separated from, but that you that the part represents the whole. And the holy is like reaching into a bin of wheat, pulling something out, you know, consecrating it, and throwing it back in and mixing it up and saying, wow, to the whole day, wow, to the whole bin. You know, and that this is indeed my Father's world. If this is, all of it is. If he's here, I go home and I pray, come Lord Jesus, be our guest. You can say it's not the same presence, but they're connected. They're related. They're not two different presences.
And that's not communion for 7 people, which is not affirming their communion.
Pardon?
I mean, with the black, you know, I'm not condemning the black. Very much.
Yeah.
But that wasn't communion for 7 people, right?
Yeah, and we the rest of us said, we should have done something. We should have gone over to the 7 people and ministered. Why didn't we break into the service? Why didn't we break into this community service, communion service, and go over and say something to them? Yeah. But we were on a schedule, and we didn't know how to deal with them. We should have dealt with them in that hour. We dealt with them afterwards.
Is that the reason that they didn't come?
I don't know.
Everybody doesn't commune every time there is communion.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. But I've observed that.
Well, there's some times when I don't want to, but I do. I mean, I really don't. It doesn't seem like community. It doesn't feel like it's Eucharistic. Not glad, and I do it because it's the Sunday.
There's a compulsion there when everybody else does.
Yeah, I don't know. In our congregation, it seems like when we have it, everybody goes. Is it different than yours?
Well, we have quite a small percentage.
Really? You really do? A small percentage who out of the congregation will come forward for communion.
But ours is very formal. We have to register beforehand.
Yeah.
And some Sundays maybe a fourth of the congregation.
Is that because they have to be members of the congregation before they can communion?
Yeah.
I see, yeah.
You know,
ours
is a whole family.
Yeah.
A whole family.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
Sure, I'd like to
ask
a question to this question. How long did you prepare for your presentation tomorrow?
Oh, I didn't. I just came out of the mountains and I said to my wife, maybe we could, whoever wants to come down and sit around the fire. And I didn't prepare at all.
I think you prepared all right.
Well,
that's the part of creativity, part of it.
Yeah, but I didn't want to do it. I really was tired. I wanted to sleep because I'd been up to Copper Basin. But I looked at that tree it seemed to say that something in the evening, at this time of the day, there should be something for someone in the village who wanted to meet someone in the faculty or who wanted to talk about something. And I knew that tomorrow was communion, so I wanted to move into that area so that when we come to communion tomorrow morning, we may have given it a different, another dimensional thought, because I don't know what the style of communion will be tomorrow. I don't know. Probably conventional, pretty conventional, would be my guess. And then I also know that usually tonight, I think there's a laying on of hands or some kind of a service, which is not exactly a foot rubbing, you know, toe rubbing, but I had that in mind when I was thinking of the laying on of hands. It's a touching service.
The reason I asked about coffee, it wasn't a facetious question.
Yeah.
It was simply this, that people can laugh and have fun, and when their friends come over, they put on coffee. So often when they go to communion, it's a mournful, sorrowful type of thing. Was not wine the social drink of the day used with the meal, that we use coffee today?
Yes, and that's very interesting, because everything that Jesus used was the vernacular. You know, he used the vernacular. He also used the vernacular language. And sometimes we get Jesus locked up in classical language and classical elements, you know, and special dress, when actually he came very homey. He came in the ordinary. Ordinary language, ordinary elements. And I must say that pressed communion wafers really bug me. I have a lot of trouble with it, because it's not the vernacular. And just to say you instead of thee and thou doesn't help me out at all. And that it doesn't go far enough. I've got to have the vernacular.
There's actually, in all the times that I've gone to communion in my life, there's only two that I remember, and that's once in the woods in Germany, and once in
Tell about the one in Germany in the woods.
Well, just that it was really cold and wet, and there was only about nine of us, and it was just they come out of a little box and draped it with a old cloth there, and then put a couple of candles on it.
Yeah.
And we all stood in a circle around it, and we just had a short service in the woods, and it was real cold and miserable.
Yep.
In our former parish, we had a family who came from another town every communion Sunday to commune with us, because in their church, communion was only for the worthy, and they felt they couldn't commune with us.
Well, did anyone go?
Oh my, yes. Interestingly enough, my husband ran into a psychiatrist at a hospital who asked about this church that was called Liberty Lutheran, where these people came from. And we don't know if this doctor was Christian or not, but he asked about the church, and he shook his head. And he said, you know, those people are really masochistic. And he walked away. Wanting to punish themselves in some way. And yet, how do you reconcile this with only being worthy? They wanted to punish themselves.
That was his opinion.
Yeah. It was interesting. Mm-hmm.
Gospel.
I think some people feel, too, that they should prepare themselves, like if they're
traveling and they walk into a church mm-hmm. and they notice now this church hasn't been meeting and they didn't know it before, they won't go. I mean, they feel that they haven't
heard. And that's how are you ever fully prepared and fully worthy?
Well, I know when I went to Bible school, or Bible camp, as a leader, when we had to meet on Sunday, well, the night before, we always had success on Saturday night in the service of separation. And in Denver, we didn't eat until after we had seen in the morning. And I do think that we thought more about it, but it was more seriously than we did walk on Sunday morning. I do think there's something worthwhile in that element of security. And I think particularly people that have grown up in Europe and been educated in the church in Europe feel this way. And I think that's where that element of feeling worthy comes too, is for largely people that have been educated in the church in Europe. I think they stress that.
I think present day Europe has swung the other way, because confession and absolution in many Lutheran churches in Europe isn't expected. There are some churches, I remember attending one Sunday morning where they had two services simultaneously for communion. The one was where you could have confession and absolution. That was in one nave. And in another one was where you could just come in and commune as you are, as a Christian. And they made a dramatic distinction. The second one was very well attended. This first one was not anymore. The first one was my heritage. And if you came in the middle of confessional service when I was a child in Nebraska, you didn't come to communion. In fact, if you didn't announce yourself to the pastor, you didn't either. But in the second style now, which is the freedom style. If you can meet Christ, and if you're ready for Christ, if you are baptized, this is your grace to come.
I've done many different things with the community, I've been writing through the church, participating in different services, and I've been participating in a legalized community of the American Lutheran Church for about 4 years. And really, I've got no qualms about whatever the community service is, and I enjoy my own congregation and any red hymnal book service as much as I do any other service, because I enjoy communion, not any type of service form or hang up about how the words are or anything like that.
That's pretty good. That Christ comes in many forms and in many styles, and that any style, even a freestyle, can become, it can become a new legalism too. Okay, we have alarm clocks and music tonight, I guess, in the Village Center.
Somewhere earlier along the line for service. Personally, I'd like to do so.
Thank you. No, I don't. It isn't.
White side is there.
White side.
And the curiosity was involved in the reading about the boxes last night.
Yeah.